Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Pop Culture Stars, back again for another great show. This is Dr. John hanging out with everybody from Interstate 85, just outside of Greenville, South Carolina, on my way to Clayton, Georgia, and Lakemont, Georgia. So it's been a great day, exciting day, and just heading on down the road doing some Pop Culture Stars. We've got a great guest tonight, of course, great panelists, and beautiful night here in the Carolinas. I want to say hello first to the man at the helm tonight, Dave Atwell. How are you doing, sir?
I am doing very, very well. Wonderful, beautiful night here in eastern North Carolina, outside enjoying a cigar from Godfather Cigars, enjoying a delicious malt beverage, and my blood pressure is a little bit higher than what it normally is. When I was speaking to Dr. John earlier with you on the phone, you'll remember, sir, where I was speaking to Dale and speaking to the dogs and speaking to Dale while I was speaking to you. I was rearranging the vines for my watermelons in my garden here, and as I was redirecting these vines, a snake skin fell on my hand and scared the bejesus out of me. And as we pulled the snake skin out of the garden and it just continued to go, it's just short, about 4 foot long. And so needless to say, my regularity is where it needs to be, and I probably evacuated some undigested meals from my bowels, which is a good healthy thing, nothing like a good colon cleanse. But it appears to be of the non-poisonous ilk, which that really doesn't make a difference to me. It's still a snake, and it still requires nuclear bombardment. But, yeah, what a find. And the last thing I expect to see when I'm shooting the breeze with Dr. John about books. So God knows what I'm going to find in this thing next time. But, yeah, back to normal. Thank goodness I have this wonderful cigar and beer to relax myself. But, yeah, talk about being on your toes. I will definitely be having my eyes out in the garden here over the next couple of days. So there we go.
At least one more. Not the Garden of Eden, but the Garden of Days.
Yeah, it's fertilized good now, I can tell you that.
we'll let that joke lie. All right, well, good you're here. Now, from our northernmost outpost in one of my new favorite cities, Indianapolis, Indiana, Todd, how you doing tonight?
I am outstanding, the supernatural, and ecstatic to be here, gents. Man, it's what a day, what a week, man. It's just one of those things. Work is rocking and rolling. We got our standard craziness happen, running up on the end of our cycle, if you will, and dealing with some of the changes at work, settling into the new billet as the team lead, and we got in our new supervisor, and we're just making stuff happen. And I don't know, guys, if you guys are half as excited as I am about our guest tonight, I'll let Dr. John do the honors, of course, but the man, I'm excited about the project, just saying.
Absolutely. Well, that's great. And it was your suggestion to get Mike. I was firing everything up to work on the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference and the Georgia Bigfoot Conference. That's about all I can do right now for the next probably week. And what I can tell everybody is that I am, as I said, headed to Clayton, Raven County, Georgia. I'm going to be doing a talk tomorrow night at the library after hours, or library after dark is what they call it. We got a good crowd getting ready to assemble because I'm going to talk about my new book, Look Up in the Sky, Aliens, UFOs, and Anomalies. And so it's going to be a lot of fun. I think we're going to have a good crowd, from what I'm told. A lot of folks signed up there at the library. We might have 40, 50 people there listening to dear old Dr. John talk and continue to talk, which is about what I like to do the best. So if you're going to be in and around Raven County, Georgia, come to the Raven County Public Library tomorrow night. Talk, it goes from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. I'll be there. I'll have some discounted tickets for the Georgia Bigfoot Conference. I'll have some posters for the Georgia Bigfoot Conference and just a lot of great things. Books, my new Bigfoot Explorers book will be there, and also Aliens, UFOs, and Anomalies. I'll have copies of that. So be sure to show up. It should be a blast. Tomorrow night, 6 to 8 p.m. So now it is my great privilege to introduce a friend, someone who's been a big supporter of Cape Fear Comic Con and all the crazy junk that I do up in and around Wilmington, and I think one of the more talented people I've ever met. He was the producer-director of the miniseries Vaughn, which premiered about a year ago, and it was fantastic. I want to introduce the one and only from Wilmington, North Carolina, Mike Roberts. How you doing tonight, buddy?
Man, I'm doing good. I don't know if I can live up to that introduction, but I do appreciate it.
Oh, you already have. You already have. So talk to us. Tell us what's going on in Wilmington and with you. You've got some really amazing things going on.
Yeah. Let me see where to start. About 2 months ago, we went and shot this short film called Before My Eyes, which was based off of a concept that my dad told me before he passed away. And, man, this short film has been doing amazing. It's been getting accepted into all kinds of festivals, like all over the world, national, international festivals. It's been the official selection and semifinalist at festivals in Los Angeles. And it's still got a long ways to go. I mean, it's entered into festivals all the way through, like, July of next year. It's pretty crazy. I'm also in the process. I'm directing a feature horror film that's shooting in the Wilmington area. I would say it was Wilmington, but the last time we shot Sunday, we shot at Sunset Beach. And it's for a feature horror film called Pain, which is it's kind of like a slasher psychological, it's a Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees type thing. A couple years ago, I optioned off and got the rights for a Stephen King film, well, for one of his stories to adapt to a screenplay called The Doctor's Case, which is about Sherlock Holmes. And we just recently launched a Kickstarter on it, and the feedback and stuff that we've been getting, the local, media and press, has been amazing. We're looking to go into, actual production on that in April. We're actually shooting the promo video for it tomorrow at some of the historic locations here in town. So a lot of exciting stuff and stuff that's going to keep me busy through the end of the year for sure.
Well, that's great. Now, I want to go back to something that you mentioned. You said, if you don't mind, you said there was a concept of your dad that entered into your – do you mind sharing that with us? Would that give away too much for those of us who haven't seen it?
No, it's fine because, I mean, it's been out for a while now. It's, approaching, 10,000 views on Facebook, and it's been seen on YouTube a lot. So basically, the concept was this. For those that don't know, my dad passed away on my birthday in 2016 from stage 4 lung cancer. But before he passed away, maybe about a year or so before he actually passed away, he used to come up to me all the time and say, I got this great idea for a movie. And, sometimes they were good ideas and sometimes they were just, probably already seen in another movie or something. He probably watched a movie and then thought it was his idea. But with this one in particular, he was trying to explain to me that what if everything that you're doing right now, so like us doing this radio interview right now isn't actually happening right now. One of us is laying in a ditch somewhere dying. And this is just part of a memory. This is when they say your life flashes before your eyes. So everything that you can remember from right now, from this moment to as far back as you can remember, isn't actually happening right now. You're not alive. You're not living. This is you're getting ready to die, and your life is flashing before your eyes. It would take so long that it would feel like it was actually happening. And then, of course, the more detail that he went into it was like, that's part of why, like, okay, say since you woke up this morning, right, you probably can't remember every second of everything you did, even today. You can remember certain parts of it. You can remember the main things you did, but you can't recall every single minute of what you did in a day. So it is kind of like, when you think back on it, it's kind of like a highlight reel of what happened for the day, not everything that you did. And so I my challenge was, you know, how do I take this idea and turn this into something that somebody can watch, turn it into a screenplay. And I right around probably what would have been his birthday back in May, I woke up one morning and I just started writing. And about a week later, we went out and started shooting. And before I knew it, it was done and people were loving it. We had a theatrical premiere here in town at the Point 14 Cinema, which is one of the new, you know, big 4K theaters. And it was very, very well received. A lot of people came out to see it. It was a standing ovation at the end. It was really nice to see my dad's name up on the screen. So,
oh, that's great.
Outstanding.
Wow. Yeah, pretty darn cool.
Now, my you said you've been in a lot of film festivals for this. Have we gotten any awards yet? I bet we have.
Are you talking about for this short?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't won, like, gotten a, like, an actual award for, like, a best of anything yet, but it has been, it was an official selection for the Los Angeles Film Awards. Actually, they're updating the status tomorrow, so it may have won something. But at this point, all we've gotten is the notifications that they've been in as an official selection, except for there was one of the Los Angeles Cinefest. We made it as a semifinalist. So I think that one's actually over. I think that's our official title was semifinalist. I mean, like I said, it's in consideration for over like 48 more festivals right now. So, you know, we're hoping for the best. My cast and crew was very small. My cast was very small, but it was really cool. You know, we had Pat Gallagher there from Stranger Things. He's in the latest season of Stranger Things 3. And of course we had Ryan Williams was the lead, and we used him in Bond. I use him in a lot of stuff. I really like Ryan. It's funny because we needed an ambulance for one of the scenes, obviously. And one of the guys over at Screen Gem Studios, you know, gave us one to use. And the day that we go there to use it, we find out that that's the ambulance that they're using for the Halloween movies. It actually still had the Haddonfield, Illinois plates on the inside. So I thought that was really cool that the ambulance that you see in our film is the same one that you see in the new Halloween movies, the one that shot in Charleston, and the two that they're shooting here. And
wow.
Sean O'Rourke hooked that up for us. Like he talked to some people and you know, told a guy what we were doing, and the guy hooked it up. I mean, he was super, super nice about it. And we shot over at the Screen Gem Studios back lot, you know, off to the side behind the fence, and we just pulled the ambulance over from the studio and then drove it back through the gate and parked it. So it was a fun thing.
Yeah, now Sean O'Rourke, Sean was involved in Vaughn, wasn't he?
Yeah, Sean played the casting director that you see in a couple of episodes, and every time you see him, he has a new injury. So, so like one point he's wearing like a neck brace, and the next time he's wearing it, he has his arm in a sling, and so like, you just never know what happens, what's happening to him. He just has it. It's kind of like that concept was kind of like the show 30 Rock, where one of the characters named Frank in 30 Rock, he wears a trucker hat, and in every episode the trucker hat says something different on the front, and so. We kind of leached that idea a little bit. We were like, what about this casting director that has, like, a different injury every time? And you don't really find out why. You were supposed to later on, but obviously we never got around to shooting a second season. But, you know, basically you would find out that because of, you know, his attitudes toward some of these people who audition, some of them don't like his criticism, so he would, you know, end up with black eyes, neck in the little whiplash thing, broken fingers, you know, whatever.
I like it.
Auditions for Britain's Got Talent or America's Got Talent.
Yeah,
great. Yeah. Exactly. That's a great sounding cast, and of course you had a good crew because you. You know most of the folks in Wilmington, and so I'm looking forward to catching that this weekend when I get back from Georgia.
The thing with Before My Eyes is I wrote it, I directed it, I shot it, and I edited it myself. And then my friend Brandon, who's a composer out in Minnesota, Brandon Soderlund, I use him on everything he did. Such a phenomenal job on the soundtrack. I mean, to the point where we were like, hey, we're going to – I actually talked to Brandon and encouraged him to take the title song, the Before My Eyes song, because it's such a good song. Like, I would listen to it in the car. Like, it's that good of a – like, I put it on a thumb drive. I listen to it in the car when I – like, I said, you need to put it up where people can, you know, purchase just the song, like iTunes or whatever. Charge, like, 99 cents because it's a good song. But he composed the whole thing. He did all original music. He wrote it from scratch. He also did, like, setting the mood and the tone by playing you know, certain notes and stuff during key scenes. But he had a couple of tracks on there that, you know, he wrote himself and sang on the track and everything. And that ambulance scene, if you haven't seen it, like, you when that music kicks on and you see what's going on in that short film, like, it'll just – It's like a kick in the face. Like, you just sit back and you go, oh, my God. And, like, when we were sitting in the theater and that music came on, like, I got goosebumps, like, all up and down my arms and stuff. It was Brandon's just a genius when it comes to that. And he's somebody that any time when you see one of my projects, his name will always be on there.
Well, that's great. Well, I'll tell you what. Maybe we can arrange – with you to play that next week. I'll talk with you later and see if he'd let us play it on Pop Culture Stars so everyone could enjoy it. That'd be kind of a neat thing to do as we open the show.
Sure. So absolutely.
Anyway, yeah. So tell us a little bit more because once you start telling us a little bit more about your new Stephen King project, I know that Dave and Todd are going to get in there. Like Band is asking a lot of great questions, and I will too. So tell us a little bit. What can you tell us about it? I know you can't give it all away, but what can you tell us
about the Sherlock Holmes project?
Yep, about the doctor's case.
Okay, so it was a story originally written by Stephen King. It appeared in the book Nightmares and Dreamscapes. It also appeared in another book that he did, but I can't remember what the title of that one was, to be honest. It's kind of a unique look at Sherlock Holmes, and in a way, it's also a little bit controversial because a lot of people who are huge fans of Sherlock Holmes that are not Stephen King fans. Really didn't like the story because they felt like, in a way, it might have discredited Sherlock Holmes a little bit, or made him seem vulnerable. And but there, you know, there's a good portion of them that did like it as an off piece. They the Sherlock Holmes fans look at it more like Stephen King just did a damn, you know, fan, like a fan episode or something. It's different. I mean, it's based in 1899 London. It's actually technically the film takes place 10 years after, I think it's 10 years, 10 years after Sherlock Holmes has died. And, but the story is being told by, Watson. And so it's talking about a particular case that they went on, which was basically the one thing that Sherlock Holmes always really wanted was a proper locked room murder mystery, because in every quote unquote locked room, and if you're a fan of Sherlock Holmes, then you know he never found what he considered the perfect locked room mystery, because there was always something that gave it away. There was whether a vent had been tampered with or a window, there was just never the perfect one. And this one was the time that there was a perfect one, but he may or may not have been the one to solve it. And it's definitely not one of Arthur Conan Doyle's works, but it is Stephen King, and the guy is a good writer. And, of course, I added and put a little bit of my own interpretation on it, but I did try to keep it about, you know, 95% true to the original story, because we all know that Stephen King does not like when you change his stuff up. You can find that out by looking up Stephen King, Stanley Kubrick, and find out about The Shining and how much Stephen King hated it. And I definitely don't want to be on that side of Stephen King, so I tried to keep it as true, you know, to the story as possible. But we've already started off. We've got a great cast. We've got the perfect guy to play Sherlock Holmes. We've got the perfect guy to play Watson. We're flying in a British actor named Paul Hughes to play Lestrade. So he will be authentic. We also have Colleen Morris, who has done the wardrobe on everything. She's working costumes right now on the new James Bond movie. How cool is that? But she's done wardrobe for everything. She's highly, highly accredited, and she's won tons of awards. She did there was a movie that filmed, took them about 12 years to get made, called Bolden, that was, you know, based on Buddy Bolden, the jazz musician. They spent like $70 million making that movie, and she did all the wardrobe for that movie, which was, you know, period piece as well. So getting her on board. And then you guys are all into the paranormal, so you'll probably like this. One of my really good friends is Chris Gartland, who was on the original Ghost Hunters TV show on the Sci-Fi Channel, and we actually cast her in something, and we're going to be bringing her down for that as well. She's super excited. So, you know, plus I like working with Chris. I've known her for years. And I know last time I talked to Dave. Last time I talked to Dave, you know, he had a couple of these, like, Jack the Ripper-style books that are kind of in that same period piece, and he's like, hey, man, what's going on over here? So,
hey, whenever you're ready, man, turn it loose, because I got to tell you, that Victorian era is just begging for,
sure.
I mean, everything about it, the misery, the dark corners, and it's amazing how a community of well over a million people, especially the Whitechapel area, man, I mean, you're talking about a very small community with, you know, a million people crammed in it, but yet people were still turning up missing, and you're like, wow, you know, it's just begging. You know, you got the fog, you've got the folklore, you got everything going on down there. So, yeah, I mean, and with Sherlock Holmes, too, I mean, you know, credit to everyone involved, including Stephen King, you know, regardless of what the hardcore fandom says about it. But
Sure. Why
not? You know what I mean? It's such a fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a fascinating era. And for crying out loud, you know, it's kind of like building a treehouse and not letting anybody inside of it. You know what I mean? You got to spread it around and let them in there. But, yeah, that whole era is just fantastic.
Yeah. Well, the cool thing is, like, I really like a challenge, okay? So, you know, what I'm trying to do is, first of all, I've got to make, you know, 2019 Wilmington, Southeast North Carolina look like 1899 Victorian London. So we've got that challenge ahead of us, which, you know what, we know it's not as hard as some people might think, but it is going to be a challenge. It's part of the reason, look, doing it for the budget that we're trying to do it for, we put up a Kickstarter last Monday. So it's been a little bit over a week. We've got till October 24th to raise the amount. The amount that we're asking for is 40 grand. It sounds like a lot to everyday people, but anybody that knows anything, it is very, very hard to even make a movie for 40 grand, much less a period piece for 40 grand.
Right.
The only reason that it's 40 grand does not speak about that it's a bad production or a low budget. It just speaks that that's how tied in everybody is in this community and who's a part of this project, because a lot of us are not doing it to get paid. We're doing it because it goes in front of Stephen King. You get on his radar. We're doing it because it's a chance to be a part of two different franchises. You're part of that Stephen King universe. You're also part of that Sherlock Holmes universe. So, and if you do it properly, that you can please both sides. If you can, like, me personally, and there's been a ton of people that have played Sherlock Holmes throughout the years, but my personal favorite was Jeremy Brett from the BBC Granada series. And that's who we are modeling our Sherlock Holmes after. Basil Rathbone was a great Sherlock Holmes. He's probably one of the more popular ones because he was a lot of what I knew of Sherlock Holmes growing up. But as an adult,
Oh, I was going to say, right? I mean, we all...
Oh, yeah.
God, Basil Rathbone, just saying.
But as an adult, going back and watching them, because before I took on this project, I went back and probably watched every episode and every movie made about Sherlock Holmes to date to see what I could do to do different. Because when you're doing something for a genre, you don't want to just keep repeating the same thing. I have to look at it and say, so if we do this, what can we bring to the table that's different that hasn't already been done? And but I noticed something. When I went back and started watching the ones with Basil Rathbone, yes, they were Sherlock Holmes episodes, but for some reason, all of them were like some type of war propaganda. Every single episode of the Basil Rathbones was some type of propaganda, and I didn't notice that when I was younger. I noticed it now. And with the Granada series, they stuck more to almost true to the books. Like, it's exact, there was no agenda behind it. Plus, Jeremy Brett was, a lot of people don't know, but he was like seriously bipolar. And so the type of acting that you could get out of him, and he could go from being happy-go-lucky to dead serious in a blink of an eye. He was just great. And our lead actor, I've always thought it. I was like, you know, this guy Timmy Sherrill, he's a local actor. He's been on a lot of stuff, but he also owns a comedy club downtown called the Dead Crow. And I've always thought Timmy looked like Sherlock Holmes. Like, he's got that nose, he's got the eyes, he's got that chin, he's just got that regular, like, that stereotypical Sherlock Holmes profile when you look at him from the side. And I knew, like, I was like, Timmy's an actor, he looks like Sherlock Holmes. If I can get him to audition with a British accent and be believable, this is my guy. And that's what we did. Like, when he sent in his audition, it was pretty impressive. It was like, I knew right away we didn't have to look for Sherlock Holmes anymore. And the fact that Colleen Morris is a London native and Paul Hughes is also from over there, and they're part of this project, they'll be there to help him, like, coach him on his dialect or let us know, like, if that little bit of Southern accent happened to come out in the middle of it and we got to say it again because he dropped it just for a second, you know, because it happens. You try to do a voice or an imitation or you know, hold an accent of something, it, every once in a while it slips out just that tiny little bit, that little tail. And so I think we're going to have one of the most authentic products that we can possibly have. We're actually shooting a promo for it tomorrow. I'm so excited.
Oh, man, this is huge. Hey, Mike, you touched on it earlier about the Kickstarter routine.
Yeah.
And here's what I'm going to say is one of the people that jumped in and used it. I'll have you go over more of the details in a minute. But as a user, and it was first-time user, I want to speak to it was not a pain in the ass to fill out the form. I saw the secure site, so I was comfortable with that. We're looking at the secure internet, things like that. So it was not nearly I know sometimes people are like, yeah, you get in there, you try to get on these fundraising sites, and look, it gave you the options. You want to be beat up by the email or not, stuff like that, that kind of thing. It was again, real easy to fill out, fairly intuitive. It was hell, I'm just so excited to be part of it. So, but for a user, it's easy to use. So if anybody's intimidated, fazed by that, look, go.
Yes, and here's the thing. So Kickstarter is probably one of the most trusted fundraising sites. It's used by everything. It's used by huge companies. It's used by film companies. Look how many actual movies have been put on Kickstarter and been made that were even stuff that normally would have been a studio project. I'm pretty sure Super Troopers 2 was done through Kickstarter.
Science Theater 3000 is one of them. The revival.
Yeah. So here's the thing that I have to try to explain to people. First, you're not going to go on there and contribute money and it come out of your bank account today, okay? Because one, it's all or nothing. It means we get $40,000, or we don't get a single penny. Now I said it that way because one, we cannot make this film for less than $40,000. We have to get it. And two, that way, with some of these other ones like GoFundMe and Indiegogo and stuff, this is where you start running into where people get nervous. Okay, so let's say if I did this on GoFundMe. And I said I needed $40,000, and we only got $6,000. Well, guess what? That $6,000 does go. Like, you get it. And now that's not enough money to make the film, and you can bet your ass whoever posted that campaign is not giving you that $6,000 back. So with this, with Kickstarter, you're just making a pledge. You're saying that if this reaches $40,000, this is the amount I'm willing to contribute to that. So let's say you want to do $1,000, but you don't have it right now. Well, guess what? If you think you can have $1,000 by the 24th, by October 24th, if it hits the goal, then you can pledge $1,000. And you can go back in and you can change your pledge if a bill comes up, or you can up your pledge if you put in $25 and then change your mind to change it to $100 later. But nothing gets taken out unless it hits $40,000. And if it doesn't hit $40,000, they do not – your pledge just disappears. They do not take it out of your bank account. It does not come – they do not take it. So and that's the most honest way to do it, because we can't make this film for less than $40,000. We've done the numbers. The budget really should be somewhere around $80,000. But we've pulled enough favors. We've had actors and workers come on and negotiate smaller rates, just so that we can get this done. And so far, everybody's excited. I hope we get it. The Kickstarter is not the end-all, say-all. If for some reason we don't hit the $40,000 and we don't get it that way, we've got a couple of other options of talking to some people that might be willing to put up the money for us to get it made. But that's also not a guarantee. And that's always just you talk to people and they want to see how the Kickstarter does first. And then some people, if they see that the Kickstarter is getting close, if it's up there around $30,000, I've seen people come in and kick in $5,000 at the end of a campaign to help people reach their goals. So we don't know. But by October 24th, we'll know. We'll know whether we start filming in April or whether we don't shoot it off.
That's starting to get exciting. And maybe the best news about it, as you know, I went ahead, I jumped in for 50 just because.
Yeah, you did.
I've one of the first TV series I watched when I got up here to Indianapolis while I was away from the family. I got all the way through the Vaughn series on Amazon Prime. I was able to sit there and hang out and do that. That was it was a great connection to home. Having made contact with the people involved with it, stuff like that. So that was really cool, that kind of stuff. So I was telling the wife about what I did, jumping in on it and, explaining how you had gotten it. I just the whole coup of pulling off the Stephen King script, being able to get that. And she knows Sherlock Holmes thing and all that. So, and I kind of touched on the part of two sides, two sets of icons that you're playing with. And
exactly.
She didn't kill me over it. So that might be the best news of all, because I'm actually here talking to you because she didn't through the phone and poked me out. I just thought I'd mention that,
Well, that is good news. And I do appreciate you doing that and contributing to the campaign. The biggest thing, I tell people, it doesn't matter. If you think that you can't contribute to the campaign because you only have a dollar or two, listen, if I had 40,000 people do just a dollar because that's all they could do, we could make it. but the other thing is it's free to share it. You know what I'm saying? So, tell people about it. You might not be able to put in a single dime. Trust me, I see people doing crowdfunding stuff all the time, and I'm the brokest person you'll ever meet, so I can't contribute. But I have, 2,000 people on my friends list. Somebody might. And there was one night, after the second or third day of the campaign being up, we had just broke $1,000, and I went to bed that night, and I woke up the next day, and all of a sudden it was up to $2,100. And I went and looked, and I'm trying to search these people to give them a shout out and find out that none of the people that donated overnight were on my friends list. They were all from where somebody had shared it, and somebody on their friends list saw it. And that's why I said we got 60% of our current funding just from people sharing it. So I just stress it's really, really important to just it takes 2 seconds. Click share. Somebody might help. Somebody will be there. And we just want to make a movie. We want to make it. So
yeah, we ought to share that on our Facebook page.
Yeah,
having it right there, they'd be just as quick. I'm getting under attack again. I'm sorry, guys. Sounds of freedom. But, that would be – if we can get that attached to our Facebook page, and that way if you cut all the work out behind it, that's the thing about eating at a buffet. You got to get up and go get your own chow, whereas at a regular restaurant, they bring it to you.
Sure.
We got that link sitting right there. Folks are more likely to go ahead and click on it because all the hunt is over, So, yeah, we'll have to attach that.
Yeah, and like I said, I appreciate everybody who, has liked it, shared it, talked about it. The Port City Daily, the newspaper, man, they have been fantastic throughout this whole process because this project has been about 2 years in the making. I had to keep renewing the option because we just weren't in a place where we could really move forward. And I even told them in a recent interview, they said, well, why did you choose to just now, go ahead and, since you sat on it for so long, what made you decide to go ahead and hit go live on the Kickstarter? And I said, well, I mean, the best time to get people's confidence behind something is when you have another film out there that's winning awards. I have a short film out there that I just did. It's my most recent work, and it's probably one of the best things that I've done so far. And while it's getting its recognition, and while it's winning awards, people look at it and be like, hey, what else is this guy working on? And then they go there and they see, oh, he's got this Stephen King project about Sherlock Holmes, and he won awards on the last film, so how do we get to be a part of this one? And so it's kind of like, you know, they say, you strike when the iron is hot, and while we were getting all the recognition for the short film, we just kind of wanted to piggyback off of that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, clearly you spend a lot of time with boredom. You're in the middle of another film right now. You see, there's that old slasher thing going on there. Would you say it's pain, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Just to make sure we're keeping...
directing a movie called Pain.
Yeah, so it's not like you're standing still, and, you know, I mean, you're definitely multitasking.
Nope. I'm actually working on another short film. Yeah, I'm actually also in the process of working on another short film that we've already shot a couple of scenes for, and I'm working on this one with, you guys should know, I know John knows him, with Daryl Rackley from the Rack Pack.
Yeah, Daryl.
Yeah.
So I'm actually doing another short film that is also a Stephen King film, called Stationary Bike, that I'm directing with and working on with Daryl. So, and we went and shot scenes of that a few weeks ago, but we had to kind of put that one to the side for a second while we're waiting for some other things to come into place for it. But in the meantime, so I've got, you know, I've got one short film out. I'm got a feature that started shooting this past weekend, and is going to shoot pretty much all the way through October. Then I have, you know, this short film with Daryl that is a Stationary Bike, that'll be finished before the end of the year. And all in the meantime, at some point I have to take a little trip up to New York and visit my girlfriend, and that'll be for a couple weeks, like towards the end of October, middle of November. So all the filming stuff will kind of go on hiatus for me at that point, just for a couple of weeks. And then when I get back, you know, we finish up everything that's not finished. And by the end of December, we got a clean slate going into 2020, which I already have two more short films already planned, and this The Doctor's Case. So in April.
Yeah,
and
speaking of Daryl, quick tangent. Daryl, big hugs, brother, prayers for your uncle. Just saying.
Yeah, for sure. I think I saw something that his uncle had a stroke or something, man. So, you know, I hope everything is okay and goes well there. But yeah, I also got approached by a charity about domestic violence that saw the Before My Eyes short film, and they said that little short film, which is only 9 minutes, by the way, is such an emotional roller coaster and touches people at such an emotional level that they actually want me to direct a short that's based on a true story about domestic violence, about this lady who barely escaped with her life. And I was reading her story to kind of see what was there as far as making a film. And I mean, her story is almost a horror movie by itself, man. And it's what actually happened to her is really, really scary. And it's kind of, it's just an eye opener to know that there are like people like that, that there are some very sick and disturbed individuals. I mean, this lady was beat within an inch of her life. He tried to lock her in their own house by putting razor wire out, and she managed to escape, and she was like barely clinging to life when a news helicopter saw her like basically laying in an alley bleeding to death. When they picked her up, and all because the guy didn't want her to leave him, and I read it and I was like, man, this, I don't know, this is like, that's hardcore. Like, I mean, she's a very strong person, but you know, obviously they want to do raise awareness and show that just because you're a victim doesn't mean that you have to stay a victim, you know. And so I that's something new for me. Like, that's something where somebody this charity actually approached me and said, you know, here's what we want, and we want you to do it, and we're a 501(c) or C3, and we've got all this, you know, all these different conferences and whatnot. We've got this whole distribution plan lined up, and, you know, we'd really like you to make this film. And they believe that I'm the right person to do it. So a lot of new opportunities coming from all of this, for sure.
Great, Mike.
That's very good. That would be a hell of a way to be giving back.
Yeah, no kidding.
That is, boy, that'll probably be your most emotional piece of work. That will not be easy for you, brother.
No, it won't, and it definitely won't be easy for whatever actress we choose to take on that role, because she will mentally have to go through what this person went through just to be believable on camera. I mean, for the audience to look at her, an actress who didn't actually go through that, but you have to believe that she did. I mean, she will have to go through a lot of mental preparation, and it's one of those things where I almost feel like on the film side of this, you know, when you put an actress or somebody through that kind of role, like it may be one of those things that you have to actually offer some counseling afterwards, not because it happened to them, but because they had to reenact it. And look at people like, you know, Heath Ledger, who said that, you know, his role for the Joker, like, he lived in and breathed that role so much that he actually, like, almost went actually insane and had to be committed. And there's a lot of people who have had that happen to them while acting. So when you're touching on these type of subjects, and you have to get somebody to, even though it's somebody else's story, I mean, they just have to be there mentally just to be able to pretend that it happened to them. And it's like, you almost just want to, like, have a counselor on set in case they need to talk, you know? So,
Cause that's one of those things. I would suspect that if you have an ounce of empathy in you, it's going to be brain dry, and
I mean, obviously I don't want to get, you know, too graphic with it, but at the same time, like, you have to show the seriousness of it and just how bad it is. I mean, it's not going to be a horror film. It's going to be an awareness film, and you know, so I'm kind of excited to look into what that's going to turn into, because it'll give me a chance to really, you know, kind of show my strengths in other areas. Cause I've pretty much made, at least one film of all types. You know, I've done horror films, I've done dramas, I've done comedies. So, you know, this is a new avenue for me.
Yeah. Definitely your craft. Now, let me ask you a question. You've been doing this a while, and if you could go back when you started, what would you be telling yourself now, from technique to, that's more of the technical side, being able to, for a clean environment, to be able to pull off a scene, things like that. What would you be telling yourself?
I'd be telling myself to run like hell. Don't get involved with all that crap, man. I was kind of, on my first film, back in 2007, I was kind of thrown to the wolves. I had no experience. I had never done anything before. I got thrown into the directing role for a script that I had written that somebody else was supposed to direct, because I didn't know anything about film. And it's to the point where, like, you know, I do trash talk my first film a lot, but hey, at the end of the day, we did get it made. We saw it through completion, and it got distribution. So, you know, we did everything that we could, but I personally can't watch it. Like, it's so bad, and there's so many things that I'm like, I should have done this differently. And, you know, obviously, over the years, everything that I've done, I feel like every project that I've done has been better than my last. So that's always a good thing. It's, you just don't want to start going backwards. You don't want your last project to be better than your new project. So, you know, even now, like, I definitely consider myself somewhat of a veteran. I mean, I've been doing this for 12 years. That's a long time. And, you know, but I learn something new every time I do a film. I learn from my mistakes. I know what mistakes I made when, you know, like, for instance, when we did Bond 2 years ago, there were a lot of things that could have been better. I feel like the show, like some people like the show and some people don't. What my idea for the show and what the final product was were two different things. Some of that was on the directorial side, and a good portion of that was on the editorial side. You know, when you shoot comedies, you have to have quick pacing. It has to be quick and quick cuts with the comedy. And you know, I felt like we had some pacing issues where a lot of times it felt more like a drama with some humor in it. And it really wasn't supposed to be that. It was supposed to be, in all honesty, like, I grew up watching shows like Sanford and Son and What's Happening. And so I was trying to do a traditional 80s black comedy based on all the stuff that I watched growing up, because that's really all I watched. And you know, unfortunately, I just didn't have time to do everything. So a lot of the writing got passed off to John Krebens, which I think John did a good job. But I think his humor was for a different audience than what my intended goal was. And so when you get a mishmash of this kind of stuff that doesn't, you know, you can't make jokes that certain people just won't get or understand. And a good example, and I always use this, so I don't feel like I'm picking on him or calling him out, but, like, you know, when we premiered our pilot episode for the first time, we did, like, a cast and crew, families and friends, and we had everybody come out and watch it. And there were some jokes in it that I was waiting to just kind of see what the audience reaction was going to be, because I honestly didn't get the joke. But I also thought, well, maybe it's just me, or maybe it's just a couple of us that don't get it, and there is an audience that gets it. And so we're watching this premiere, and when that particular scene happens on the screen, nobody laughed. I mean, there wasn't even a snicker. There was no, like, anything. But I turn and look over in the corner, and John, who wrote it, is laughing his ass off. Like, he looks like he's about to die. His face is beet red. It's funny to him, but nobody got it. And to me, that was funnier than the actual show, was seeing him laughing at his own joke that nobody else was laughing at. So,
boy, that's exactly how I feel about some of my jokes on this show.
Yeah, you had to be there, right?
I say that's the way people take my jokes sometimes. I think they're funny. That's bad when you laugh at your own jokes. Tell John
right.
It's bad to laugh at his own jokes. He's got to stop it.
Yeah. I like John. I wouldn't have brought him on to the project and let him, you know, write six episodes if I didn't think he was a funny guy. It would have worked for a different show. If we were trying to reach a different audience, it may have worked, because I think the audience, the targeted audience that we were going for, was just not there. And then when you have, like I said, when you have a conflict in your writing between what the show is supposed to be and what it is, and then your pacing or your editing is off, and you're like, I watch it, and, like, don't get me wrong, like, I don't think it's a bad show. It's just not what I intended for it to be. I intended for it to be something else. But it is what it is, and it is, like, it's free on Tubi TV right now, and, you know, people are watching it. Like, I got the numbers back. It's getting watched for sure. It was also on Amazon Prime for a long time. It still is, but, you know, not as many people are using Amazon Prime because it's not free. So, but Tubi TV is free. It just runs ads. And, I mean, I get the numbers every quarter, and I'm just shocked at, like, you know, the amount of view difference between Tubi TV and Amazon. And so I technically – it's a hit show for Tubi TV. But, you know, hey, I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot from working on that sitcom, even though that was 2 years ago. And at the time, that was the best thing I had done to that point. And now, you know, fast forward to now in this short film that I just put out recently, like, you can just see the growth. You can see sometimes as a creative person, I feel like I have to take matters into my own hands. And if that means I got to write it, direct it, edit it, and use my own camera and film it too, because I can't trust anybody to shoot exactly what I want, because I'm the one with it in my head. I know what I see. And I can't expect that other people are going to know exactly that. And especially when you're working with little or no budget, man, it's just sometimes it's faster and easier to just grab the camera and shoot it yourself. So,
Well, let me throw this out there, though. That sometimes with the writing, with Strange Bedfellows, you'd be surprised what comes out. Like, I think oftentimes that people don't realize that Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles, that co-writer was Richard Pryor.
Right.
That is not the first pairing anybody would think of.
No, it's not, but... you could, when you watch Blazing Saddles, you can see that element of it, because you can see two really far extremes. First of all, let's just state the obvious here. You cannot make a Blazing Saddles right now because everybody's too fucking, excuse me, too offended at everything.
Boy, you sound just like us. That's for the record.
We have definitely had this.
This discussion, but you want to think about this, take that thought a little bit further. They couldn't even do the freaking Weird Science today because of making that girl out of the doll.
And what do you think would happen? What do you think would happen if they decided to do all Archie Bunker all over again, you know? And on the opposite side, Do you think with everything going on right now that they could actually air the Jeffersons?
No.
Taking it all the other side? No, because
Do you remember the Jeffersons with the son-in-law and all your photos are black and white? Like that comic could be made today? Really? All your family photos are black and white? Please.
Yeah.
The Office was, 2005 when The Office started? And ended 2000. I mean, some of the stuff that The Office was doing, if you tried to even remotely pull that stuff now, I mean, it's just amazing how much people have forgotten how to roast themselves. And just because I crack a pasta, I'm an Italian guy, and just because I crack a joke about, my blood type is marinara sauce. People are so quick to get bent out of shape, and I'm like, God, it's a great joke, man. Laugh at it.
Yeah,
see, out loud,
see, right there. That was an example of when you tell a joke and nobody laughs but you. But I'm just kidding. I love you.
It wasn't me for a change.
I know. I was just teasing. But no, seriously, what you said about Richard Pryor and Mel Brooks, okay? Now,
right.
You take they're the absolute, complete polar opposite of each other, let's face it. And the thing with Blazing Saddles is it didn't just attack one person or one race or one – it went after everybody. You were not safe if you were white,
definitely.
Jewish, black. It did not matter. But it's always been considered – a classic. It's been considered a classic. It's like one of the funnier things that me personally, I still think Mel Brooks' best movie was Spaceballs, but that's just me. Because I grew up in the era of Spaceballs. So, plus, come on, John Candy. But, that movie, at the time, appealed to all audiences because everybody thought Richard Pryor was funny. It did not care that he would get up there and drop the N-bomb or, you know, other, you know, the word, like, he was the guy. He was the MF guy. He would drop every curse word you could think of, and he would call people, you know, slander terms. Like, it just, you can't, like, I can't even say what he would call them now because they'd be ringing you guys up trying to get you shut down for letting somebody say it on the air. So, you know, it's like, but that type of thing, that type of humor that you saw, like, that stuff did get toned down, obviously, for TV because of different regulations. But, like, if you ever saw, like, episodes of Sanford and Son, that's probably, like, to me, that's probably, like, one of the more iconic shows just because, like, you know, the way they talk to each other. And it showed, like, honestly, almost like a real-life kind of thing. Like, these guys ran a this wasn't, like, an imaginary story that's unbelievable about five really cool white friends living in an apartment. This was two working-class guys, him and his son, that own a junkyard. You know what I'm saying? Like, this was life. And everything that happened to him was something that was a struggle for real life, but only for a certain class of people, and not a race, but a class of people. And by that, I mean poor people, because I was one of them. I grew up on Section 8, and I grew up on welfare, and, you know, but so everything that they would say in those kind of shows would ring true to me, and that's what made it funny, was because this guy's got the balls to go out there and say on TV the things that we're actually thinking over here. And, right. That was kind of what we wanted for Vaughn. Vaughn was supposed to be more along those lines, and it would have, like, little skit comedy-type parts in it, like when he would think back and remember stuff, which, you know, it still did that in the show. Like, in the pilot episode, we switched to where he was part of a Castlevania video that ended up getting used for a porn website. There was one where he does a flashback where him and Stefan are kids and they're competing for roles up on the stage for theater. And so these were supposed to be like the little skits you would see on In Living Color. Like, do you remember the show In Living Color used to come on after Married with Children?
Oh, my God.
So this was the kind of...
That show could be on... That show could not be on the air today.
Absolutely not. Absolutely. Can you imagine them doing the men on films and the men's on sports and stuff like that? Like, can you imagine them doing that?
How about Handyman?
Oh, yeah.
Handyman. Yeah.
With the Tiny Avenger.
The handicap superhero.
Yeah.
The handicap superhero. I mean, nothing that they did on those shows was politically correct because they weren't scared of offending people. They wanted to make you laugh. And, you know, Dave Chappelle just did a recent stand-up that just got released on Netflix like a week or two ago, and I actually watched it. And I was like, he's got to be the freest man in the country because he doesn't give a shit what you think.
No.
Like, he just gets up there and says it. And people hate it. There are a lot of people that are like, oh, you should ban Dave Chappelle from Netflix because he's talking about the – At first, he wouldn't even say. He was like, you know, the people I'm talking about, the ones that stole half of the alphabet to describe their name, the L, B, Q, T, you know, he's like going through. And obviously that caused an uproar, right? So, but if people, like, he was even talking about how, like, that community don't even get along with each other. He's like, that's why it's not in alphabetical order, because they argue with each other. So you got to put the L's over here because they don't get along with the T. So you got to have a G in the middle, you know. And so, like, I mean, should he say it? I don't know. Like, morally and ethically, there are a lot of people who take offense to it. But the question is, why now? Why is it offensive now, but it wasn't back, you know? It's anyway.
Yeah.
I
and you
well, I'm not
well, here's the thing. I think maybe, we only had, there are those of us that remember three channels, and then, wait a minute, we actually got a UHF UHF antenna, so we got five channels. Mind you, that fifth channel was only sometimes, so we'll leave that aside. But it was okay because we knew how to change channels if we didn't like something, and we just shut the hell up. Yeah, you know what? I'm not going to watch it. I don't dig it. But I ain't got to – but here's the thing. We did not have to bitch about it or be butthurt about it.
We just changed the channel
and called it a day.
Yeah, like you said, back then you only had four other channels to choose from. But now you got millions of channels, plus streaming, plus YouTube. So you don't have to watch it. There's plenty of other options. Go watch something else if it offends you. That's what I mean. But look.
There we go. Hey, they can still change the channel, but I don't know. Maybe it's that just feel there's more options to get hurt by. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's,
You guys are forgetting we still have Bravo and Lifetime.
Well, look, okay, so
I'm sorry.
I'm not in the business. Look, I like everybody. I have friends of every single thing that you could watch or people get offended by. I've got friends from all of those communities combined, all over the place. Some of my best friends are, you know, part of those communities, people that I've known and worked with for years. And, I honestly understand, like, things get said and they can be hurtful, and I'm not saying I condone any of that. I really don't at all. And being a person who works in the film stuff, I don't let any of that stuff ever happen on my sets. Like, we had so if you ever watched the pilot episode of Vaughn, you'll notice that he had a specific agent, and then all of a sudden in the second episode he was firing that agent and got a new one. Well, that's because while we were shooting the pilot, I had numerous complaints, females on my set that came to me and said that this person was saying some inappropriate stuff. So off camera. So I got on the phone with him, told him he wouldn't be coming back, and that, you know, I absolutely don't allow that kind of stuff. And I mean, look, you can have your opinions or you can whatever, but I mean, we're there to make films and entertain people. I'm not there to, like, hook you up for the weekend.
Let me tell you some craziness. We had, I had a conversation with someone today about food in different countries. I'll just give you a quick background. This person mentioned that they had several dogs, and then we got around to talking about it. And I was like, man, you spend all this time in such and such place. Were your neighbors jealous that you had a buffet in your house in reference to the dogs? Because this person fully understood the culture. They didn't freak out or whatever. But it was just, it's just like there's some cultures that eat horses and stuff. But somebody's going to freak out that the fact that I mentioned this, that there are cultures that eat horses or cultures that eat dogs, or, you know, it's one of those things. But it happens. It happens. And just for the record, that culture is still alive and kicking, so it's not killing them, for starters.
Sure.
You know, it's just their culture. I ain't saying I approve or disapprove or just, I'm aware of it. I'm just not going to freak out.
Yeah. All
the stuff that's going on in the world right now. You know, I was picking up some groceries the other day and had a lady stop and ask me to get some off the top shelf. Now, for all of you that know me, I'm, you know, 5'7" on my good days. And so I looked right at her and I said, you came to the right place. You got the tallest guy in the building, ma'am. And busted out laughing, I had put my foot on the base shelf, reached back there like a knucklehead, like I was a three-year-old trying to get to the cereal box. So I pulled the thing down, handed it to her. She thanked me and everything. She says, well, thank you so much. I said, hey, not a problem. I says, actually, you made me feel good, if you want to know the truth. She says, what are you trying to say? I says, well, normally I'm the guy that always gets asked to get stuff off the bottom shelf. I said, getting stuff off the top, I feel like Superman all of a sudden. And, you know, I've been 5'7 for the last 20 some odd years. You don't think I've figured out that I'm not going to be dunking any basketballs. You know, when the Celtics cut me, I was pretty busted up about it. But hey, you know, I figured it out pretty good.
But, yeah, right.
You know, it's one of those things where people are in such a rush, and I don't understand why, because there's so many things out there that stresses us out now that we didn't. Take, for instance, like my internet service. My internet service sucks. Without lack of better term, it sucks. It's forever crashing. You're forever having to run back, you know, fix the router. And it always happens when you're in the middle of watching something on Netflix or when you're getting ready to put that final bid on eBay or something, and it crashes on you, right? Well, 25 years ago, I didn't have that stress. You know, you drop your cell phone and the screen cracks. It ruins your day. Okay, 25 years ago, we didn't have that stress. So there's so many things out there, you know, that are added on to it that we didn't have 20, 25 years ago, stress level wise. So
don't you miss the days where you could like go to the grocery store and if somebody was trying to get up with you, like, and you didn't answer your house phone or they stopped by your house and you weren't there, like they just had to wait. Like, now they seriously, it's easy. They're going to call you, they're going to text you, they're going to email you. It doesn't matter what you go do. It used to be you go to the grocery store to get an hour out away from the house, you know, just, like, go be away from everything. But nowadays, I mean, that's you can't go anywhere. You have all that.
You get a hold of them, you know what I mean? So you got a rogue ass chewing coming up because you didn't stop what you were doing, whether it was saving a drowning child or maybe fighting away a bear attack.
God forbid that somebody keep a notebook in their vehicle to leave the note at your door. Hey, stop by to see the, you know, wanted to double check if you wanted to get together on Thursday night for pizza or whatever the heck the case may be. You know,
right.
They would just leave a note, boom, that was it, and they'd slide it in the damn door.
Yeah, and it's funny because cell phones went from a luxury to a necessity.
Yeah, to a random pain in the ass.
Yeah, now, Mike, I got something to tell you that has never been done in a film, and you need to do it. It is the nuisance phone call on your cell phone. I never see that. They live perfect lives. Their bank account
is
always about. It's the nuisance phone call, or it's the friend calling you and bugging you in the middle of the checkout line. I never see it in a film.
I see it all the time. Did you ever see, what was it? Which one was it? It was Yes Man with Jim Carrey. Did you ever see that one?
No.
This will put a little bit of a date on it, but he's standing in line at a Blockbuster Video. His cell phone keeps going off, and he won't answer it because he doesn't want to talk to the guy at that moment. And what he doesn't realize is the guy standing outside the building looking in the glass and sees him standing in line. So he happens to look over there and see him. So he real quickly puts the phone up to his ear and starts moving his mouth like he's actually talking so that it would look like the reason why he wasn't answering the call is because he was already on the phone. they've kind of done it in a way, but.
Point well taken, but I never tend to see a lot of reality in films. Everybody's always got a perfect life or they've got perfect problems. They can't ever get away from it.
When are they going to put out that reality paranormal show that shows what people really do at all those ghost hunts and stuff when it's in the dark and they just have to check their Facebook real quick?
Oh, my. I tell you what, if we do the reality show about my Bigfoot sighting up in Lakemont, Georgia, I almost had a stroke. So we'll have to make that one, okay, buddy?
All right.
And speaking of that, I got to say this. I am in the middle of the forest, and I know I'm going to have no cell phone signal. I'm going to let my guys continue with you, Mike. Thank you very much. I'll get up with you soon and take care. Guys, I'm signing off because signal will sign off for me in a minute, okay?
All right, John, you have a good one.
All right, John, big hug.
Okay,
take care, buddy. And we're about 5 minutes away from doing the plugs. I want to make sure there's plenty of time so that way Mike can get everything in. Mike, if you would, you know, when we go to the plug time, man, load us up,
sure.
Baby. Let us know a little bit. So, you know, that way that we can help you out the most we can. So, but a sidetrack question I've been meaning to ask you, and I'm glad you came on tonight. Excuse me, it's a totally different topic of what we've been talking about, so pardon me for the misdirection. But you're talking about filming in Wilmington. Now, bearing in mind all the monkey business that's gone on with the film industry in North Carolina, thanks to our wonderful legislature, what kind of energy, what kind of I would imagine there's probably still an excitement in Wilmington, but what's the climate down there? Are they feeling more like, hey, we got to get this back on track, or more like, well, guys, I reckon we ought to move on, you know?
Look, to be honest, I mean, they're slowly getting back on track because we've had Hulu's reprisal shooting here for a while now. You know, they're picked up the two They picked up the two Halloween movies, so the Halloween 2 and then the sequel, or the trilogy, the last two of that series anyway. And then I don't know if you guys saw, but the show The Lost Boys, that's based on the 80s vampire movie, they're turning that into a TV show. That pilot's coming here to shoot. I also happen to, you know, see on some stuff that where there are some projects coming in. There's also some projects here in town scouting. The person, one of the guys from that produced Dawson's Creek is back in town. Took pictures of himself and put them on like Instagram and stuff of him over at the studios because they're looking to possibly reboot Dawson's Creek. So there is a lot going on right now. The film incentives, I actually had a meeting with the local 491 yesterday to talk about the Sherlock Holmes stuff. They reached out to me and they're in full support. I mean, they said, look, you've got our full support. We're going to do whatever we can to help you get this made. And I was so humbled by that, like that in 12 years, I've never been contacted by any of the unions trying to help out, and like my little independent stuff, you know? And, there is a lot of stuff going on, but the thing is like when they changed the incentives and it went from tax credits to a film grant fund, like a state funded fund for a grant, but then they made like the minimum spend more expensive than the average person could use. You know, you can't, the big Hollywood productions can swing that, but you know, when you're saying that, you know, we have to have a $250,000, even $1 million budget just to qualify. I mean, that you're talking big numbers. I mean, I know what I can do for 40 grand, but if somebody gets me $1 million, you're going to see some stuff.
But as a matter of fact, we got the camera girl for you when you get that kind of money, because you'll be meeting Liz Brackett when that happens.
Oh yeah?
Because that's our camera girl.
Okay. I mean,
but, you know, the thing about North Carolina, and I had a gentleman come up to me at one of the shows I was doing, and he was looking at my first two books that were, you know, set in the American frontier. And he had asked me, you know, hey, has anybody ever approached you about taking this to television or, you know, film? And I says, well, yeah. And I keep getting the same thing, that anything that involves horses and the frontier type thing, you know, it's always that much more expensive and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
And he looked at me, he says, hey,
you're in North Carolina. And I looked at him and I said, yeah. And, you know, he almost told me what I already knew. You know, we fought the American Revolution here. We fought the Civil War here. We have mountains. Yeah. We have a beach. We have the plains. We have forests. We have beaches.
Sure.
We have ocean. I mean, North Carolina has got so many different
they're a very versatile location. I mean, you can pretty much show anything, which is part of why I wanted to do the Sherlock Holmes thing in the first place, because there, at that point, if we pull it off successfully, there's no excuse. Somebody can't say, well, you know what, we can't shoot it here because North Carolina doesn't look like this. Look, if I made it look like 1899 Victorian London, y'all can make it look like anything. So don't use that excuse.
I mean, you've got Tryon Palace right up the road here in New Bern.
Exactly.
Which was
good. And I'm actually trying to talk to them. Like, we're trying to shoot at Tryon Palace, as a matter of fact.
So, I mean, the possibilities are there. That's why the whole thing with the restructuring the film industry, it's like that brought so much money to this state, and it's such a head-scratcher that that they went out of their way to tangle with that. I mean, if there was one positive thing going on in this state currently, you know, in the same state where we're trying to legislate which bathroom to use, why did you go out of your way to screw with the film industry? You know,
honestly, that is something that hurt the film industry, not just the film industry, but everything. I mean, there were basketball championships that were supposed to be held in Charlotte that didn't get held there because of that, you know, HB2 law. But the thing is like the biggest thing that North Carolina had going for it was the infrastructure. We had Screen Gem Studios. We were the largest studio on the East Coast. We were the top three biggest studios for production. And the problem is that when we allowed places like Georgia, and yes, we allowed it because Georgia wouldn't have existed if we would have kept a choke and a stranglehold. Sure, they would have shot things there, but it would never have become the powerhouse that it became if North Carolina would have been more competitive. So the thing is that the infrastructure that we had left. Everybody that was here that was, you know, their whole livelihood was based on the film industry had to go where the jobs are. And I knew numerous people that picked up and moved to Atlanta and lots of people who picked up and moved to Louisiana or, you know, wherever the stuff was being shot, Charleston, South Carolina. And so we still have a lot of talented crew here. Don't get me wrong. Like, we have plenty of people that can make movies for these large budget productions. But it's not what it used to be. It's not but the good news is a lot of that hype for Atlanta is starting to die off and projects are starting to come back. I won't say that it's because they switched it to that film grant because it's still, you know, it's still not as good as the tax rebate and it has a cap. And, I mean, let's face it, we lost a movie here that was supposed to be based on the actual name of the show is called OBX. It's based on the Outer Banks, and we lost it to another state. Are you serious? There's a show about the Outer Banks. It's called the OBX, and we lost it to another state because they had a better incentive. That cannot happen. I'm out here. I'm doing what I'm doing because I'm fighting. I'm just a little guy. I'm on the independent film side. I don't have the stuff that these guys have with the unions and everything. I don't. Hopefully by this time next year, you know, I'll be part of the Directors Guild and I'll be using that status to try to fight to bring more projects here because they can attach me as a director once I'm a guild director. They can attach me infrastructure here. They have a director in Wilmington, DGA, that they can use. Hopefully that's the case because I'm trying to use everything I have to platform, you know, bringing projects here, even if, especially if it's a Wilmington, like if anything in the script actually says the word North Carolina or says the word Wilmington, but you tell me that it's shooting in Montana, then we failed. We failed.
Exactly.
And I'm going to be there. Like, I'm going to be championing and trying to do everything I can in every project. I don't care if a studio – if my first studio film is a $100,000 budget and it's, you know, The Conjuring 12 or whatever at that point, and they want to film it, I'll bring it here and I'll film it. I can do that. So I'm looking to champion, you know, to – I want to be that guy out there campaigning to get these films brought here as a reliable director. I'm not doing it just to make little films to, you know, put on YouTube or show friends or enter into festivals. Like, I have to think of the bigger picture. And for me to do my part, if I can use what I'm doing now to springboard into bringing, you know, at least two or three bigger projects here, or a single big project every year or so, then I've done my job. That's what I want. I want to bring the projects here.
There's so much talent and so much desire down here, you know, to knock it out. So, I mean, it would be a missed opportunity if we didn't. But with that being said.
Hey, Dave, we're under five.
That's it. If you don't mind, Todd, I'm going to donate my plug time to Mike. If you'd like to do the same and just turn over the last 5 minutes of this show to Mike, just, man, plug it up. Tell me everything you want to know, everything you need.
Yeah.
Shout it out.
Yes, I mean, give some big love to Mike.
Okay, well, I appreciate it, guys. And all I can really say is this. Everybody talks about all the time how they want the film to come back to North Carolina. They want to do films here. And it's like, here's your chance to, quote unquote, put your money where your mouth is. I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm saying that in an inspirational way, that you have a chance to have a project that could lead to some bigger things, regardless of what happens with this project. And to do that, we need everybody. We need the city. We need the community. We need everything. I mean, hell, the local 491 is even jumping on board with us, you know, so... as much as they can help out, there's no like contract or anything like that, but they're going to do what they can. I feel like if everybody chips in, this isn't just my project. This isn't just my actors and my crew. This is Wilmington. This is where if Stephen King came here and shot Firestarter, which was one of the first big films that shot here. Then he came back and shot Silver Bullet, Maximum Overdrive, Cat's Eye, Night Flyer, and then even as recently as coming back and shooting all those seasons of Under the Dome. This is Stephen King territory. This film industry here would not exist without Stephen King. And what do you do? Like North Carolina and Wilmington and everywhere, you know, North Carolina as a whole has lost focus as far as what to do with the film industry. What do you do when you lose focus? You get back to your roots. So we have a chance to bring another Stephen King project here, to put it off, to do it, to put it out, and hope that it leads to more projects down the road. And to do that, for anybody that wants to help out or be a part, you can go to Kickstarter and you can look up the doctor's case or my name or whatever, and it'll come up. And you can contribute or you can share it. I mean, that's really the two options. But don't ignore it. Because ignoring it is basically saying that you really don't care as much about the film community as you say you do, or as much about wanting film back to North Carolina as you say you do, if you're just going to ignore it. And that's pretty much it. Like, there's a Facebook page for The Doctor's Case. You can go there. All the information is there. You said you guys are going to put it on your website. So, you know, feel free, put the link up there. And that's it, man. Hopefully by October 24th, we'll be talking about, you know, our first day that we're going to shoot in April.
Man, what way excited, Mike. Seriously excited. This is huge. This is, I'm digging it. You've gotten the accolades on at all these different places, and I am extremely happy for you, and you well know I'm excited about the project.
Man, I do appreciate it, and I appreciate all you guys' support. And I just give one last little thing, man, because, you know, sometimes it's not about you know, what they actually do for the project or whatever, but I got to give my girlfriend a ton of credit because she's put up with me for 4 years. She knows I work in film, and she knows that sometimes that gets a little bit busy, but she's always been supportive. And also, like, to be honest, like, a lot of this stuff, like, doing these kind of things, it inspires me, like, to want to be able to do these. Just as weird as it sounds, because I want her to be proud of what I'm doing. And when I know that I'm making her, like, kind of proud about the stuff that I'm doing, like, I just feel really good about it because she's been so supportive. So I just have to give her a lot of props, because there's a lot of days where I don't feel like doing things. Like, I have an anxiety disorder. So, you know, but she is definitely one of my biggest inspirations in completing works, and she's always trying to keep me creative. So I just wanted to toss that out there. You know, sometimes people don't get the recognition.
To the one we love.
And her name is actually on the Stephen King contract too, to be honest, because she had to sign as a witness. So I'm sure that was, like, really exciting for her that she had to sign as a witness on that contract.
Very cool.
And it's like, okay, so her name is on a contract that involves Stephen King, and I think she actually enjoyed that. She didn't understand why her signature would be important, but I told her, you know, it's a very important signature. You're the witness, and now Stephen King's got a copy of this in his files. How cool is that, right?
Dig it.
It's called Brushes with Greatness, man. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, but with all that being said, not to cut it off, shoot, we probably could have gone 2-3 hours tonight with you, Mike, and we appreciate you getting back on with us and everything. And,
yeah.
You know, of course, we'll have you back when the time permits for you more than us, because we're always willing to have you back. But, yeah, very much obliged for you joining us tonight. We'll go ahead and get links shared and all that kind of stuff. And, man, good luck. And understand that all of us here at Pop Culture Stars are always here for you, and we're always pulling for you, man. So thanks again for being on. Todd, thank you again for all your hard work as a co-host here. And to Dr. John, who is probably being attacked by another random Sasquatch as we speak. I hope everybody has a wonderful evening, and take care, be safe, and try to take care of one another. All right? So from Pop Culture Stars, good night, everybody. Thanks again, Mike. Thanks again, Todd.
Yep, thanks for having me, guys.
Big hugs, all. Great show.